great pleasure to be introduced as somebody else's relation. As throughout the course of this weekend, someone whose name will not be mentioned, past my lips, has been mentioned so many times, David.
Douglas Hurd.
Douglas Hurd, exactly. Yeah, little Castlereagh. Anyway, it's lovely to have David here at this closing session. It's been a wonderful weekend, especially the weather today. And David, I've worked with, and in preamble, in preparation for this event, I not only wrote his brilliant book, which actually precedes his marvellous autobiography, which is called Party Animals, My Family and Other Communists,
yeah.
Which is a whole other conversation entirely, maybe for the next Mike Stewart Conversations. Anyway, I emailed one of David's editors and I said, please give me something funny to say about David, because otherwise I'll have to dredge out the anecdote about when he was at Manchester University and every single question that Bamber Gascoigne answered, you said... You answered each question with...
That's the legend, is that we, on University Challenge, we said Trotsky or Lenin to every question they asked, yeah.
And why did you answer Lenin, Trotsky, Stalin to every question?
Well, we... You know, people who've seen the film Start of a Ten know that most colleges... had this sort of kind of procedure and auditions for University Challenge. Well, we weren't. We were elected at a union general meeting on the basis of manifestos about how disruptive we would be on University Challenge and so on. And there were me and three anarchists. And so the idea was that University Challenge was a terrible elitist program that didn't allow any polytechnics. Do you remember polytechnics?
Yeah.
Didn't allow any polytechnics on, and gave a team to every separate little teensy-weensy Oxford college. So you come in from Snot College, Oxford, etc., with three students, and you'd have a team. You only had the four students in the team were the only students there, and then you'd have something like Manchester University with 18 million students, and they'd also only get a team. Yeah.
All right.
That was the idea.
So it was a protest?
It was a protest, right. Yeah. And a rather childish one. And
well, it's gone down in history. But anyway, to return to what Emma Tucker, the deputy editor of The Times, said in response to give me something to say about Big Ron. Oh, where is it? She said something like, why don't you read Big Ron's piece in T2 about Freshers Week on Monday? There must be something in there, desperate series of question marks, or something about his weight. You could talk about that because you've lost so many pounds. You've got this weird app. Anyway, it goes up and up until Nicola Gill, the editor of Times magazine, sends him to a fat camp for a mag feature. Then he goes back to the beginning and the cycle repeats.
Pretty much true.
Pretty much true.
I mean, it is pathetic.
Yeah.
Some of you may recognise yourself in that and some of you may smugly not.
But we are here to talk about your brilliant book on conspiracies. And before I picked it up and read it, I thought, I really love a good conspiracy. I mean, I was the sort of person who watched that Loose Change documentary about 9/11, and I made my children watch it, and I told them it was an inside job afterwards. So I think the first question...
You didn't.
I did. And only reading your book has persuaded me otherwise, honestly. I thought there was gold in the base... In the basement of the World Trade Center. But before I read your book, I thought, what's wrong with a harmless conspiracy? And then when I read your book, I realised there's quite a lot wrong with conspiracy and our addiction to them. And I wondered if you could start by answering that.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, the book started both in a frivolous place and a serious place. The frivolous place was that I had gone on a journey for the BBC to Tunisia, this is before the Arab Spring, to do a kind of little report about what it was like to in tourist destinations that actually had horrible governments and so on. And I was a very, very good producer, and we had to drive around a lot together, being kind of undercover. And on one of these drives, he was driving along, and he said to me, you know the moon landings? And I kind of did, because I was 14 when they happened and so on, and I think he hadn't been born at that stage. And I said yes. He said, they were faked. I said, what do you mean they were faked? He said, they're faked, they were made, that never happened. And I said, look, before you give me all your evidence, which doubtless will be incredibly interesting and so on, let me just tell you my instinct, which is it would be harder to fake a moon landing than to have a moon landing,
yeah.
If you think about it. all the people that would have to lie about what they'd done, etc., for the rest of their entire lives, etc. So it would be more difficult. So my instinct is that you're wrong. I can doubtless find out the reasons why you're wrong, and subsequently I did, and all the kind of idiocies about the photography and so on. But what interests me, I said to him, is why you think it. Why you, and I thought, and so I wanted to write a book about that. And then you subsequently come across quite a lot of these things, including some of the conspiracy theories actually I'd believe myself. Classically, my generation was brought up thinking that it was impossible that Lee Harvey Oswald was the single gunman in the case of JFK. Sorry, folks, it just really was. But, you know, everybody from Woody Allen onwards took it as a kind of item of faith that it was actually a complicated job, grassy knolls and all this kind of stuff. So there is the bit that you say, which is the intriguing and kind of fascinating bit. But then there are bits which are genuinely incredibly harmful. So the book starts with the one of the most pernicious of all, which is that there was a secret Jewish plot to subvert the world based on a forgery called the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which after the First World War got fantastic degree of coverage. It was sort of the kind of viral video of its day, but in pamphlet form, went all around the world and was translated and purported to be the record of people at a secret meeting at the World Zionist Congress in Basel, when they'd had a report back, effectively, from all the top Jews of the world who'd been organising the secret conspiracies and so on. Then, you know, the people who'd got there to subvert the press, and then the guy who'd been there to subvert the world of finance, and then somebody else, you know, all these Jews kind of reporting to each other on the progress of their terrible plot. And the idea was that what the Jews would do is they'd take over everything, including all the parties, foment real trouble. So all the trouble that was going on between anybody, no matter what it was Jews, okay? And then they would get the world to the brink of civil war and war, like what happened in the First World War, so that was their fault too, and so on, and then revolution. And at that point, the world population, staring out of this terrible abyss, would look to somebody for some kind of help and leadership, and whoops, there would be the Jews. So that was how it was supposed to work. People believed this stuff. They believed this stuff in their millions. It was a very, very big organising pamphlet for the early Nazi party and so on. But also was believed. There actually was an editorial in the Times that said, well, this Protocols of the Elders of Zion seems a bit rum, but actually it seems to correspond to what actually happened. We'd better have an inquiry into it. A bit like today, really, etc. Anybody runs a really silly theory up, you have an inquiry into it. And that was an example, and there are many others of a kind of pernicious theories, in which essentially you try and explain something immensely complicated and difficult, which might actually implicate you, because actually who were the people applauding the beginning of the First World War? You know, well, loads of people in squares, etc. Adolf Hitler, for one, in the big square in Munich, etc., throwing his hat in, waving his hat at the declaration of war. And many of the theories since then, I mean, I do go into some of the ones that are just fun, etc., but many of them since then act in a way as a way of blaming some agency, etc., for the complexity of the world in order to try and kind of deal with, you, if you like, with the kind of the difficulty of just how chaotic and complicated life can be.
So do you think people want to believe always in conspiracy rather than cock up?
Yeah, I think some people. I think some for some people, it's a very. I mean, we all know people, and one or two people in the audience may be those people who are serial conspiracy believers and so on. You know, the people who say, "Well, you know," or the person who takes a kind of malicious pleasure almost in saying, "You know, that's what you people who believe what the mainstream media think, but actually, I've been on a website and I can tell you it wasn't like that," and so on. And there's just, you know, there is that kind of, you know, somehow or other. If I tell you the alternative truth to what everybody's saying is the truth, that makes me a rather kind of heroic and extraordinary figure, a sort of rebellious, you know, a kind of Robin Hood of ideas, really. And if I tell you that, so there is that kind of attraction for some people, but I think there's a kind of something else really. I mean, one of the areas I look at in the book is specifically those areas of dealing with the deaths of really famous people. I mean, Kennedy is one very big example. Princess Diana is another really interesting example from here in Britain. We maybe go into it in a little bit more in a moment. Where essentially, in America, after Kennedy was killed by Oswald, there was nearly a nervous breakdown. Because people said, what kind of country are we that where a nutcase can kill our president on the streets of an American city? This is intolerable. Well, one way in which you make it in some way psychically tolerable for yourselves is you say, ah, but it wasn't a lone nutcase, really. It was a kind of incredibly complicated, nefarious, secret thing, carefully organized by groups of people. In other words, there's an intelligence at work there somewhere. And the implication, even if it is unconscious, the implication of having this kind of agency that can do these terrible things is that also conceivably in the world you could have agencies that do really good things as well. Somebody somewhere can organise the whole lot for you. Well, you and I kind of know, as we kind of gradually learned and as we sit rather closer sometimes to the corridors of power than we would do, that actually it's incredibly chaotic in them. You know, it's difficult.
But conversely, people, when it comes to 9/11... people were also reluctant to believe that Arabs could have organised the destruction of these pillars of American, power.
Yeah, no, it was absolutely great. At one stage or other in 9/11, there are a group of people who believe that Israel organised it. And you think about the kind of double racism which is involved in this imagination. Yeah. One, Arabs are too dim to organise something really bad.
But to have done it.
Yeah, so Jews must have done it all.
Yeah.
That's absolutely brilliant. You get to get two fabulously racist positions for the sake of, you know, for the price of one.
You've mentioned the protocols. What about other conspiracies that politicians have fanned for their own purposes? I mean, what about Trump and the birthers, for example, which I think he's just recounted from, hasn't he? He now agrees that Obama wasn't born. But why did he jump on that conspiracist bandwagon?
Well, in the book, which the chapter on it, which was written before Trump espoused, Trump was very late to the birther conspiracy. The birther conspiracy theory started in 2008.
Everyone knows what we're talking about.
Do you know what a birther is? Okay. A birtherism is believing that Obama's not really an American. Okay. Which means if he's not really an American, then he should never have been president. And we can get rid of our minds of Obama forever. We can expunge him from the record of president because he wasn't really one. But back in 2008, there was also the theory that you could actually stop him becoming president, and by 2009, that maybe you could disqualify him from continuing to be president on the basis that actually he hadn't been born in Hawaii, although some of the birthers thought Hawaii wasn't a state of the union. Yeah. They got that bit wrong, so they thought they were. But that actually, the record of his birth had been falsified, and he'd probably been born somewhere like Kenya, etc. Yeah. Now, there are some problems with that, which is that actually his birth generated two notices in the local Honolulu papers generated by the Department of Health then that he had been born there. It wasn't generated by his parents, and the only way it could be a conspiracy is if they had somehow worked out that 45 years later he would become a presidential candidate.
Yeah.
This is not so much conspiracy as prophecy. But nevertheless, a really big kind of big element of the Republican Party, of the edge of the Republican Party, devoted itself to the proposition that actually he was illegitimate. He couldn't just be wrong. He had actually to be illegitimate in terms of his Americanism, the first black president. And so they set up this campaign to have a look at his proper long-form birth certificate. Show us the birth certificate, otherwise we're not going to believe you. And in the latter stages, Trump jumped on that bandwagon before he was a candidate. Now, what Trump did by doing this was he identified himself with a kind of insurgent wing of the Republican Party, which has later been the wing which has carried him as far as he's actually got. It was a point of identification which helped him locate himself politically, even if, to most sensible people, it utterly disqualified him from any kind of, you know, from any kind of office whatsoever. It is a birtherism with regard to Obama. It's not only stupid, but it is actually pretty racist, actually. Why the first black president, he's not really an American. You can see, in a sense, what's going on there, and so on. But what I discovered when I looked into birtherism was that the first people who really gave impetus to the Bertha conspiracy theories were the same people who had run incredibly elaborate conspiracy theories about Bill Clinton during the early days of the internet in the mid-90s. There were whole kind of groups of right-wing semi-journalists and the sort of first, you know, what people who used to begin to call themselves web researchers. Mm. That is a terrible phrase, by the way. If anybody ever tells you they're a web researcher...
Run for the hills.
Yeah, run for the hills.
Sorry to interrupt.
Actually, where they live.
As a conspiracy junkie, what were the... What were the conspiracies about Bill Clinton, about murdering Vince Foster? I mean, are we going in too deep or too...
There's a fabulous book called The Secret Life of Bill Clinton by a guy called Ambrose Evans Pritchard.
Okay, well, we know he is a nut job.
Yeah, no, they don't. He works for the Sunday and Daily Telegraph.
He is a nut job. No. Now I know what you're talking about, all of that stuff, white, black, you know.
Yeah, it was kind of Bill Clinton had run a narco empire in Arkansas secretly, had had loads of people bumped off, and so on, you know, run drugs.
The question arises as you're talking, do you think there's a obvious correlation between low IQ and people like me who believe in conspiracies?
No.
You don't? You think clever people
can
be conspiracists?
Definitely.
Okay.
Kevin was an example that we started with.
Oh, yeah, we need to talk about Kevin.
Very good. We have, so that was gratuitous.
But you need to explain who Kevin is, because he triggered the book.
He was the guy in the car in Tunisia.
Oh, yeah, you didn't say his name, though, did you?
No, I didn't say his name, no. It was a throw. where were we?
He was the one who said the moon landings... were made of cheese, or you know that, right?
Yeah. Oh, you were talking about clever people.
Yeah, but
almost all conspiracy theories come from educated people, the educated classes. Almost all of them. I mean, in somewhere like Pakistan, where conspiracy theorism is absolutely rampant, I mean, if anybody ever says X did Y, their automatic position is no, the Americans and the Jews did it. It's no matter what it is, no matter who's done what to whom. They're beginning kind of, you know, now there are a lot of them being murdered by the Pakistani Taliban. They're beginning to revise their views. But for a very long time, this is a kind of absolute default position. And the people who propagate the theories are the educated classes in Pakistan, the lawyers, and so on. Almost all 9/11 conspiracy theorism in America originated amongst university students and academics. There's a whole big group called Academics for 9/11 Truth. Scholars for 9/11 Truth. I'll talk a bit about them in here. Now, of course, they weren't specialists in the things that they were talking about. They were led by a theology professor who necessarily hadn't specialised in aerodynamics and building engineering and so on. But nevertheless, these were not stupid people.
Okay.
They were people who had made themselves stupid.
By their system of beliefs.
Some sense you're saying... I've been on to this guy, David Ray Griffin, who was one of the chief theologians in America, still is, who has written something like 10 books on 9/11, saying it's an inside job and so on. Something like that. He says, well, I didn't initially want to believe it, but then I came across some interesting websites. And you think, you just didn't see it coming, did you? I mean, you know, journalists know... that one of the things that you have to do on the internet is to discriminate really carefully between the various things that you will see on the internet. And by and large, if something's origin, an extraordinary new story, has its origin on the internet alone, it's likely to be bollocks. As a technical term we use in the anti-conspiracy lobby.
Did you develop any theory about people who believe in conspiracies with complete absence of real evidence? Do you think it's at all comparable with people who believe in an unseen hand or a deity? It's a different system of belief.
It's an obvious question in a way. Doesn't this have some kind of relationship to religion? Mm-hmm. Or in fact to any other faith-based belief in which the desire for the thing to be true allows you to accept its truth. The only thing about conspiracy theorism is it goes to incredible lengths to justify itself. So if you can imagine, I mean, the equivalent would be the kind of Christian who says, I know exactly where Noah's Ark landed. And not only that, but there's archaeological evidence, they found a few bits of the Ark. That's the kind of thing. Now, quite a lot of Christians will say, well, of course, we don't, can't be sure of such things, etc. But I base my faith both on my own experience, etc., and upon, if you like, the kind of ethical values and so on. Conspiracy theorism actually says, no, you know, actually, I've seen a really good article with several footnotes which clearly show that Jesus walked the earth or something like that. So so there's a kind of greater... There's a greater determination to find spurious evidence to justify the claim because people want to lay claim to rationality. They don't want to suggest that their conspiracy theory is faith-based. They want to suggest that it is rooted
evidential
and based in real evidence, unlike the kind of nonsense that sheeple like you and me believe, which is, you know, the official version which is given to us by people like us.
Some of the most popular ones are to do with Christianity, though. If you think about it, you know, the Da Vinci Code and the Turin Shroud and Ark of the Covenant, you know, they're box office. I mean, presumably this is why everyone keeps these conspiracies going. I mean, the Daily Express would have died a death if it hadn't had Diana.
Yeah, no, well, Diana's a really, really interesting example because it goes back to this question of the intolerable nature of something like accident.
Yeah.
Okay. And if you think about the way in which we all kind of create patterns, so one of the things that we should know about the patterns of events is that you get, in random events, you get clustering. So it's the kind of classic thing, Guildenstern and Rosencrantz are flicking their coins, etc. Heads, 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 it can't be true. But actually, heads, 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 heads is quite likely to happen. It's just that if you do it enough times, by and large, you'll balance out across them. But instead, we see always the pattern that doesn't exist and the coincidence that isn't really, and so on. So we notice something when it seems coincidental. We don't notice all the things that aren't coincidental and consequent, and we construct a pattern out of something like that. And so we're always looking for something that kind of gives some kind of backup to the idea that there are organizing principles in the world rather than, if you like, a sort of degree of randomness and a degree of chaos. And for some people, that's much more necessary than others. Some people literally cannot cope with the notion that a major iconic princess is oft in a car crash.
Or no, just dies in a car crash.
Yeah, oft.
You said is oft.
Yeah, yeah. Well, however, by God, seatbelts and so on. And so, in the immediate aftermath of Diana's death, firstly, there was the attempt to say it must be the paparazzi's fault and so on, you know, because they chased, etc. Well, in a kind of sense, that's true, because she wouldn't have been dashing across Paris in quite that way if it hadn't been for the paparazzi and so on. But nevertheless, there then becomes the moment comes just a few months after, when ITN run a serious documentary fronted by their royal correspondent on all the reasons why it's likely that Diana actually was murdered, all the evidence for it. It's all entirely spurious, and some of it is just wrong, etc. But you get down to kind of really funny bits, you know, the white Fiat Uno that might have sideswiped the Mercedes. Well, okay, if you're going to sideswipe a Mercedes, are you going to use a Fiat Uno to do it? No, you don't, because actually what's most likely to happen is that the Fiat Uno will get the swiping, etc. It's a much kind of a smaller kind of vehicle. What kind of theory rests entirely upon Diana deciding not to wear a seatbelt? She could easily have worn a seatbelt. Well, once this objection is presented, sure enough, a year later, a book comes out saying they could have filed down the seatbelt pins. Yes. There's no evidence that they did, but they could have done. They're incredibly kind of, you know, there must have been 30 books of Diana conspiracy theories. And anybody who had an existing conspiracy theory, like, say, Mossad does everything, would find a Mossad link to Diana being killed and so on. And it was, you know, and Diana was pregnant. She wasn't. Diana, you know, she was about to get married to Dodi. She clearly wasn't about to get married. And it ends up in this. I'm just going to read you a little bit at this point, because those of you who followed this may remember that in the end, we even spent a whole lot of money, millions of pounds, on something called the Stevens Inquiry, and we also spent millions of pounds at a contested inquest, in which, essentially, the counsel for Mohammed Al-Fayed had been arguing all the way through that there had been some kind of conspiracy. And Mohammed Al-Fayed had begun to suggest that in on the conspiracy were people like Trevor Rees-Jones, the bodyguard in the car, the only one wearing a seatbelt, who was incredibly badly injured. Michael Mansfield is a kind of doyen of left barristers and so on. He's an incredibly arrogant man. I mean, spectacular. The Guardian described him as the light shining off the silver highlights in his well-coiffed hair, his brilliantly coloured silk ties illuminating an otherwise drab courtroom. So that's what he was like. So he's giving it out large all this time about the possibility, and he still believes it, Mansfield. Even after all this happened, he would still say, I still think something dodgy happened to Diana Ezra. So they've been running this theory, though. Tony Blair's involved, the Duke of Edinburgh. Yeah. Poor old Philip, etc., is somehow involved in this terrible plot, and MI5 have helped him. So they've been making all these implications, but there's a problem. Once you get to a court of law, you actually have to come up with the evidence, not just the theory, you have to come up with the evidence. So after a while, the coroner asks Mansfield about the allegations made by Al Fayed against Trevor Rees-Jones. And the coroner says this: are these allegations being maintained by Mr. Al Fayed? Because if so, Mr. Rees-Jones is entitled to be told of any evidence in support of them and to give us his explanation. You'd have thought, wouldn't you? Mansfield says, sir, I have been very careful in the examination. I have not maintained those, and I am not in a position to produce any material to support them. Coroner, why haven't they been withdrawn by Mr. Al Fayed since 9th of February 2006? They are very grave allegations, and one would have thought that a man with any decency who was not going to pursue them would withdraw them. Mansfield, and you've got to enjoy this. May I say this with regard to that? I appreciate the nature and gravity of the allegations, and I hope that in the longer term, his position will be appreciated, and that is this. That he has been very concerned from the beginning to discover the circumstances of the crash, and obviously what lay behind it. There have been many beliefs that he has held, and in my submission, he was quite entitled to hold certain beliefs, and obviously to see whether, in the longer term, when those beliefs were, as it were, exposed to this inquest, whether there was material which supports them. It's very difficult for those people in those circumstances to relinquish a belief that has been firmly held, even though, as it may turn out, there is very little material to support the belief that they have, for example, that it's not suicide or it is suicide, whatever it is, and therefore I hope that it will be understood that obviously it's for the person individually to obviously make that clear. Now, how would you sum that up? Would you not sum that up as my client has not produced one scintilla of evidence to support these incredible assertions he's been making, but I am too much of a shithead to apologise to you? Wouldn't you?
I can't even remember why people thought that Prince Philip would kill
because
Princess Diana.
It all goes back, and this is kind of, it's in the book, in a way it goes back to the way in which the Diana myth was created. And it goes back to that moment when she did the Panorama interview with Martin Bashir. Mm-hmm. When she says, they didn't want me to be queen, but I will be what?
Queen of people's hearts.
Queen of people's hearts, but they didn't want me to be queen.
Can we just talk about this the use of the word they, which is actually very common.
Yeah.
I remember going to a restaurant in Portugal with the brother who's now foreign secretary when he was only 19, and he ate a piece of fish. He became ill afterwards, and he said, they are trying to kill me. But now he's foreign secretary, goes around in an armoured convoy. I keep saying to him, they really are trying to kill you now. With four armed security guards. And he says, yes, they still are. Whenever there's a helicopter, I say, watch out, you know, a drone's coming over. Anyway, but we all have this concept in our minds of they.
Yeah.
And even the royal family isn't immune. You say this thing from Diana as if that was unusual. What about the Queen when she said dark forces?
No.
There are dark forces at work in this country. Do you remember when she said that?
Well, I remember that Paul Burrell said she did, but I don't.
Didn't she say somebody else?
Well, she didn't say it to me.
I mean, even the Queen thinks there's a conspiracy somewhere of somebody.
Yeah, dark forces. I mean, the idea that, you know, the Queen is not part of the establishment is such a sort of fabulous notion.
No, but what's so interesting about that is even the Queen Queen thinks there is some higher power, some higher organising power that might be doing something even she doesn't know about.
Yeah, do you know what? Somehow or other, I just don't think it went down quite like that. Think it was one of her clever jokes. No, I just don't think it went down
like
quite
like that.
Like
saying to Princess Michael, far too grand for us, you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose it's possible. I mean, she would have been... I don't know how hurt she was by the kind of rash of... I mean, the period after Diana died was pretty hurtful for them. We do know that.
And don't forget your idol, Tony Blair, actually allied himself with the people against the palace in that moment.
Didn't he? Idol wouldn't quite be the word, but even so, I would say that you're entirely wrong. What that leaves out, but this might be a slightly different argument, was that she was under intense media criticism, and Blair understood the way in which she had to get out from underneath that. Now, of course, it was resented in the palace that effectively other people knew better what was good for them than they did at that point. But nevertheless, you know, he and Campbell.
And he was the one who coined
it.
The people's princess as well, yeah. Didn't he? After her death.
Yeah.
I wonder who actually wrote that.
She was, in a sense. He did.
Did he?
Mm.
Yeah. Right.
Oh, you think it was the Jews?
That's right. But there was that thought, just
very
going
important.
Back to Diana and that whole business, that because she was going out with the son of... She actually wasn't going out with Dodie. You know, that was a smokescreen because, hold the front page, she was really in love with this surgeon called Hasnat. And the whole Dodie thing was, she thought that if Hasnat saw her out on a yacht with Dodie, he'd get so jealous that he would come running back to her. He wasn't like that. He was Pakistani. He didn't want to see anybody. You know, he was romantically involved with or wanted to be on the sidebar of shame. So that all ended when, in fact, she did do that, you know, lingering shot on the yacht or being in a clinch on the boat. Anyway, where do we go? So the whole business... But out of that faked-up romance grew the theory that she'd been killed because she was going out... And this is what Mohammed Al-Fayed clearly believed as well.
We didn't want a Muslim
exactly.
to be in any way heir to the throne, etc. Not that he would have been, not their progeny would have been. It was all kind of slightly ridiculous. And then somebody created the theory that actually she was killed because of her involvement in landmines, in stopping landmines, and that the British government was so interested in selling landmines it thought it would be worth killing her to stop her being involved.
Tis
in the landmines. It's a whole book. Whole book devoted just to that. Another book saying that she was in favour of Palestinian rights and that therefore MI5 and the Israelis have got together and got another kind of variation on the Jews done it theories.
But what would be Prince Philip's motive, just to finish on Diana?
Just bad temper. sheer malevolent grumpiness.
Did you, in the course of writing the book...
Well, nobody rid us of this turbulent princess.
How much of the other books could you bear to read, or did you just, you know, pile
read,
them up?
I read loads of them, and I mean, also there were some challenges to my own kind of theories. I mean, it's quite often still taught in schools that in 1933, after Hitler took power and the Reichstag burned down,
they did it,
and of course this fits a kind of picture of what Hitler would be like, and so on. But when I started looking at that too, it did seem that the most reasonable theory was that the guy who said he'd done it all the way along and said he'd done it on his own
did do it on his own.
Hitler tried to blame the communists because he wanted it for his crackdown, and there was a significant crackdown afterwards. All the other parties were made illegal and so on. And the communists wanted to blame Hitler for secretly doing it, and that's what they did. And a very big international operation run out of Moscow was put up to show that Hitler did. Well, guess what? Stalin won that one, like he won the one in 1945 as well. Because that was what was believed. And that is the way it's often taught in British schools as a fact. Hitler secretly set fire to the Reichstag in it? Probably not. Probably the guy who said he did it and acted alone did it and acted alone. Is that disappointing, though?
Yeah.
I mean, who's going to read a thriller like that?
But David, I mean, when there was that coup in Turkey, people used the example of the Reichstag fire all over the place, as if that was also, to explain the coup in Turkey, Erdogan did it himself because it actually served his purposes so he could crack down even further. But And then they said it was like the Reichstag fire. But now you're saying that actually it wasn't a Reich. It was a false analogy.
No, there wasn't a Reichstag fire. And this sort of false analogy happens all the time. In the case of Turkey, you'd have to... I mean, there were Air Force pilots who very nearly shot Erdogan's plane
down. He organised that too.
And so on. Yeah, well, the idea that he organised... Exactly. You know, yeah. So he incredibly cleverly organised that as well to the sort of minutest conceivable detail. And so one of the things that often happens with kind of conspiracy theory is a reference to the previous conspiracy theory. So you say... that, well, if they could kill Kennedy, they could do X and so on. So yeah. It's not so improbable as you think it is, this conspiracy. Now, one of the questions that always comes up, if we had time for questions, would be, are conspiracy theories never true? Or very hopefully somebody will ask, is there no conspiracy that you found was true? Hoping that I'll say, yeah, this one's true. You're going to go off down the pub and say, well, that one, that you know, it's kind of kosher. It has the imprimatur and so on. But by and large, if you define a conspiracy theory as a desire to believe in a set of explanations that are less plausible and involve a conspiracy, then by and large, they're not going to be true. Now, of course, that doesn't mean there are no conspiracies. So you take something like Watergate. There was a conspiracy at Watergate, but look at what kind of conspiracy it was. What was the conspiracy at Watergate? It was they wanted to get dirt on the Democratic opponents in the 1972 election. So a hugely daft man who was employed by the Nixon White House, and who incidentally, as one of his first, is Gordon Liddy, as one of his first moves, brought his team in to show them in a briefing room in the White House, Leni Riefenstahl's film, The Triumph of the Will, to kind of get them in the mood. Yes, seriously, etc. This is the kind of guy you really shouldn't employ, and so on. They go out and they go down to the Watergate Center and they start burgling the Democratic offices. And what happens in this incredibly detailed conspiracy? The security guard catches them. And when the security guard catches them, what are they lifted out of there by a secret combat team from some shadowy paramilitary organization? No. They wait because the security guard calls the police and the police arrest them. Okay. Now, the then cover-up is whether or not Nixon knows about it, but that is what the Watergate conspiracy is essentially about. It's not some kind of incredibly competent way of organizing, of getting something done.
And I think you say also that he never wiped the tapes. I mean, if it was a really good conspiracy...
Yeah, he doesn't even wipe the tapes. He doesn't even wipe the tapes properly. He gets himself taped, this great conspirator, and these tapes are lying around for people to discover.
Would you have been shocked in the course of your research if you'd proved any of the conspiracies? Or did you go into it assuming they were all just cock and bull stories?
No, I mean, as I said, some of them I had actually kind of believed, and I was brought up
which
thinking...
Which ones?
So the Reichstag fire. I believe that.
Ah, you believe that too. Yeah, but we were taught that in school.
And I think I still half believe the JFK one up until the point where
I actually did it properly. Did you, by the way, go to the Texas Book Depository and stand in the window? Because I have.
Have you?
And I complete... And also, you know that there are all...
Were you there in 1963?
I wish I had been. But anyway, I did go there. And by the way, the conspiracists are all there. They're like people who camp outside the Chinese embassy on Portland Road. They are there all the time, peddling... their pamphlets and so on, and their Lee Harvey Oswald T-shirts. And I actually bought, you know, a copy of JFK's autopsy. But I stood in the place that Lee Harvey Oswald was supposed to have taken, where he'd supposedly aimed at the motorcade as it came across, was it across his direction? Anyway, and I thought you could not hit a president in a moving car from this room, from this window. But he hit him with three bullets.
Yeah, of course. Well, he actually hit him with two. But
okay, well, the magic bullet.
Hit him with two,
third bullet.
With a rifle, with a telescopic sight, and it was travelling across his line of sight slowly. So there you go.
Yeah, but you haven't been in that room, and I have.
Did you look through a telescopic sight?
No, I didn't. No. You're quite right. I didn't know it was a telescopic rifle. No. But what I did learn from this brilliant book, by the way, is that Lee Harvey Oswald had actually killed someone before or something.
No,
he had attempted an assassination.
He had very nearly killed somebody else before in Dallas. He'd only just missed this guy, this general.
So he'd been practicing on someone else.
Yeah.
We have questions.
We do. Every day is a learning day at the National Trust for sure. So we're going to throw open the floor for at least 3 to 5 minutes of questions. So if anyone has a question for David or Rachel on these wonderful conspiracy theories, can we have it now? I'm going to hand over my microphone to you.
Thank you very much for an absolutely fascinating conversation. Really enjoyed it. Just on this question of, I would be cock-up rather than conspiracy every time, but isn't there a danger that by too easily dismissing conspiracy theories, that we do miss at least some of the substance to some of them?
It's a very good point intellectually, but in practice, when you look at what these things actually are, when it comes right down to it, most of them are really dumb, okay? And there is a problem with believing kind of dumb things. Now, also, there is definitely a pattern to people, to the way in which people tend to believe things or put spurious evidence together to kind of construct a theory. So sometimes it's true, you can kind of see the thing coming before you've actually examined the evidence. So I would say you can't dismiss anything until you've looked at the evidence for it and asked people to produce the evidence for it, whether it's credible or not. But it's definitely possible to say that one explanation is pretty much more plausible than another, and that therefore the person pushing the really implausible theory really has to do a job of showing you why this theory is true. But yes, the habit of mind of skepticism is always a good idea. One of the things that's funny, actually, is I think conspiracy theories are sometimes the least skeptical people you will ever find. You know, really unskeptical. They will believe any old nonsense.
Hello there. One conspiracy theory that I would believe would be that private banks create money out of nothing and issue it as debt and get interest off it. I wonder if you've came across that, David, and what would you think of it?
Can you just say it again?
Sorry, private banks would create money out of nothing and issue it as debt.
Sorry. This is a really embarrassing moment. I might have to apologise to you. I can't...
Private banking.
Bank.
Banks.
Banks create money.
Private banks create money out of nothing, yeah.
Out of nothing?
Yes.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. Banks do create money out of nothing. I had this explained to me in a program that's going out in a couple of weeks' time for a thing I do on the... they do create money out of nothing. If you generate a mortgage and you borrow the money... you borrow money that the bank has created for the purpose of that transaction, and when you repay it, that money is destroyed. So it's true that the banks do create money. Yeah, that's not a conspiracy theory. That's how the system
is. Sad fact.
But I didn't quite realise that. I mean, it is true that most people actually tend to believe about banks that what you do is you lend them your money, they give you 3% for it. Ha, brilliant old days, huh? And then they lend it at 6% to somebody else, and that's how they make their profit. In fact, that's not been the way the system's worked for quite a long time, but it was always the way we were taught at school. So it's one of these things that when you discover that the world is considerably more complicated and it's slightly at variance from the simple way you were taught school economics, instead of saying, oh, I've learned something about the way the world works, we say, oh, it's a big conspiracy there.
Thank you, David. One last question from Chris in the front row.
How much of it is an incestuous relationship with the press and media, in the sense that conspiracy theories need press and media, and the press and media need conspiracy theories?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that Rachel will be as aware as I am is that we... journalists live on novelty and the capacity, and to a certain extent on sensation. And novelty and sensation is what you get when you get a conspiracy theory that you could actually conceivably run with. But on the other hand, quite a lot of journalists are quite experienced at dealing with the complexities of the world, because they have to report, you know, so they get a sense, like historians do, in a sense, for the way in which people actually work and what's likely and what's not. Not infallibly. I'll give you an example. The Mail, hated and hates Tony Blair. Absolutely hates him for a whole world. But essentially thinks that the world started going towards homosexuality with Tony Blair, etc. You know, in that sense, it's a little bit like a wing of the DUP that believes it's the same kind of thing. I remember once when I came to Northern Ireland as a student leader, it was really great. I went up to a Portrush college, and there was a guy called Alan Kane, who was then a DUP student. He then became a DUP politician. And he asked me, tell me, Mr. Aranovich, he said, is there any sexual perversion perversion that the NUS does not support. Which I thought was a really good way of putting it. I thought, not many. Not many. And, you know, so there becomes this kind of, you know, belief that... actually, I've lost my track now.
Well, we're talking about the press and conspiracy theories and how we sort of feed off each other.
Oh, yeah, we're talking about the press point and so on. So the Daily Mail has Tony Blair in its sights. So one of the things that it ran was a conspiracy theory hard to do with David Kelly and the death of David Kelly, which was that these five doctors, supposedly, actually most of them retired, usually kind of, and not in the field, would come and say it's actually impossible for David Kelly to have killed himself in quite the way that the report to the Hutton inquiry said it did, and therefore actually he was probably murdered. It's a ludicrous theory. I deal with it in a chapter in the book because it's such a kind of interesting one. They kept on, the Mail and one or two other papers, coming back to it again and again, despite the fact the facts never changed in it and so on, but they would just run it again until finally there was an inquiry and they all got bored with it. You know, the thing came out of the government and so on, and then it just died away and we replaced it with the much, much longer business of Chilcot.
Yes.
David, Rachel, thank you very much for what has been a fascinating hour. I'd like to really genuinely thank you, and if we can just have a round of applause for David and Rachel.
Thank you very much.
Just while Rachel gets disconnected and dashes to the airport to get a plane, I'd just like to... I think I got disconnected too. I'd like to really heartily thank all the audience here to Mount Stuart over Saturday and Sunday for what has been the inaugural event for the Mount Stuart Conversations. We really hope that this is the start of a journey, and I'd like to just thank a few people, but most heartily I'd like to thank our volunteers and staff here at Mount Stuart. They have been fantastic. Thank you. To the speakers, you have been stimulating, exciting, sometimes slightly controversial, and we have loved it. And I'd just like to finally thank Lady Rose and Peter, who are here today, for their generosity of spirit and just for making it a wonderful weekend. Thank you, everyone. And can I just mention, the cabaret is about to start, so you can seamlessly move from this tent over to some fantastic music from local people. So please enjoy and come back to Mount Stuart soon. Thank you.